I don't know why in Montana we keep not looking at our greatest asset. It starts with the soil, and people do not understand
that. I'm Coulter DeVries, accredited land consultant with the Realtor Land Institute and accredited farm manager with American Society of Farm Managers and Rural Appraisers. Thanks for tuning in to the Ranch Investor Podcast.
Ranch Investor Podcast is the most downloaded and informative industry-specific content that intrigues while entertains.
Ken, you didn't need to bring a notepad.
I know, but I was scared I was going to forget something, so I thought I better.
Well, you're not in the hot seat, so,
okay.
So no worries here.
All right.
I brought you on to hear what you're up to.
Oh, okay.
We were shooting the shit a little bit before the recording button got hit, and we're catching up on all the old times of Class C basketball in Montana.
Absolutely.
You're telling me about the family's 800, 1200 head operation in the Shields Valley.
Yep.
Well, that's pretty coveted.
Yeah.
Everyone wants to be in the Shields Valley.
Yeah. It was a grassroots organization, of course. You know, we're the grandson and great grandson of homesteaders that came from Norway in the turn of the century. And we never had anything to start with. So we had to cash flow from the start, and they actually lost the homestead during the Depression, and they were able to buy it back, but that was our start, and they had four sons, five sons actually. One died of appendicitis, but when you couldn't, just a horse and buggy, you couldn't get them into town, you know, to get it taken care of. So that uncle of mine died, but they came down to the Shields Valley from that Ringling white sulfur area after World War II in the early 40s and later 40s. My dad was in the war and my uncle was in the war, and they came home and they started buying some land around Wilsell. And like I said, we always had the cash flow. So it was a slow gain, but my dad was, before he graduated high school, he was Charlie Bear's driver for two summers. And so he drove all the way from white sulfur all the way down to the Crow Agency down here. And I think my dad, it kind of warped him after that. I think he had bigger thoughts, you know, even as a 14 or 15 year old driver for Charlie Bear. I don't know. I think he got the big picture after that. So he was always, maybe let's say he always pushed a little harder and maybe had a different outlook than a lot of people did. And so he was kind of the driving force behind the brother. He was always the wheeler dealer land trade, and his brothers were involved in the operation. One was in a full partnership with Len, and then Carl was another brother. And then they could buy bigger parcels because they pull all their assets and do it from that. So,
and we're, for context, we're talking about Charles Bear, who is one of those Montana cattle barons. He actually was sheep. He had about a million sheep.
That's what they said, yeah.
A million sheep, and they would run them from, as you mentioned, the Crow Reservation. This had to have been the late 1800s.
Yeah, early 1900s.
Early 1900s. They would run them from the Crow all the way up to Marr County. And for all the Texans wanting to buy an elk hunting ranch in Montana, it's Marr County, not Meager, Irish. But Charles Bear still has the Bear Ranches in the foundation. The Bear family made millions, and they contribute to the universities and different scholarships. Very charitable trust at this point. But one of the original John Duttons of Montana is who Ken Arthon is talking about. And Ken Arthon is one of those names. You talked about the homesteader legacy, probably a lot of Norwegian boys, a lot of bachelors to marry off and go start another homestead. So Arthon is one of those names that in Montana, where fifth generation Montanan like me can hear that you're an Arthon, and I'll say, oh, you're either Joliet, Absarokee, or the Shields Valley. Kind of like the Simontons. Someone says they're Simonton, I know immediately they're from Northeast Montana. Or a Schwinn, I know that they're from Joliet or Bridger. There's just some of those family names, and you're one of them.
Yeah, yeah. We've been there a long time. I can hardly go anywhere in Montana if I mention my name or And the people always know. You're around some place like that long enough, people just, it's just your name precedes you, sort of, you know, and it's a weird, it's strange, but that's the way it works in Montana.
Well, and that's one of the dying legacy, the dying cultures that unfortunately we have to accept. We bring up here on the podcast quite a bit is you, Class C basketball, Shields Valley, most of your teammates were farmers and ranchers, right?
Totally.
And then you guys would go play little towns like Fromberg and Roberts, and you played against some of my uncles and cousins, and I don't have any actually uncles you would have played against, but you would have played against some DeVries cousins, and we have that commonality across Montana from all the way from Ekalaka in the southeast, 900 miles northwest to Eureka and every point in between, and that's dying. That's what do you see there in Marr County and Wheatland County? Those are, because of the mountains there, those are two highly desirable areas depending on what side of the mountain someone wants to be on in Sweetgrass County.
Yeah, absolutely. It is totally changing, though. I think there's very few total farm and ranch families in the Shields Valley now.
Just the homesteaders.
Yeah, just
probably the third plus generation.
Yeah, just a handful, and a lot of those places, you know, have been split out, and more are going to be, you know, so it gets less and less every day. But as you were speaking there, it was so cool. We went against one family particularly from White Sulphur that. My dad played his dad, I played him, and my sons played his son. So,
White Sulphur's just down the road.
Yeah, it was just quite a rivalry, and they were all good friends. You know, it's just what happens in Montana. You
have those rivalries, small town, either inner district when they're just 20, 40 miles down the road, or else when you get to divisionals and they're 3 hours down the road, and then when you get to state and they are 7 hours down the road, but Montana is just one long main street, right?
It sure seems that way. It's just incredible, the connections. It just overwhelms me almost every day.
So like me, you've identified that, hey, I can't fight this. Market is changing. My neighbors are billionaires, and cash flow isn't necessarily their primary reason for buying a ranch as it was for the families that you grew up with, had the cash flow, that was their existence. So you've identified a need for some local management. Is that correct?
Yeah, we had the opportunity to sell some of our bottom ground to my, so I sold it to my brothers and my cousin. And then we ended up buying a place in Plentywood, and my son is up there right now on that. So we've changed that way, and it gave me an opportunity to kind of open up my scope a little bit, and that's why I've started a land management consulting deal, and it's to help the new landowners kind of to identify their place, because you know, having a lifetime in the ag background, you can see things, then you grew up knowing things, and the people that are coming in don't necessarily know this, you know, they don't know about noxious weeds or erosion or soil health or water development that's why I started the business. It's called Earth and Resources, and it's to help those people and so that they might have a better buying experience, and that their neighbors might have a better experience too from that.
Because you've seen a few newcomers come in and probably maybe no fault of their own, not understand the water rights or the fencing issues.
Yeah, totally.
And then that could start off on the wrong foot, and then it's not too fun for the next many years between neighbors.
Yeah, you know, the saddest thing is that, you know, us Montanans, if we have a disagreement, it's better to stand toe to toe, and you can always work something out. It's just amazing what you can do when you stand toe to toe and communicate. But it seems the first order of business anymore is you run everything through a lawyer, and God, if you really want to screw things up, that's a great way to do it. So, and it seemed like it can you can spend millions and accomplish absolutely nothing. We're a handshake, and maybe a few thousand dollars would have been all that would have had to change hands. You know, I've seen easements go awry and water rights go awry and about everything imaginable in those terms. And it's just, it's really out of just kind of lack of shared knowledge. And so that's the reason to get together. And a lot of the people don't realize that coming in, but it would be great if they did.
Lack of shared knowledge, and granted, sometimes these agreements for access and water usage and fencing, trailing livestock across someone's place, a lot of times those are verbal and generational. They're not recorded, they're not written, they're not signed. There's been no compensation made. It's usually just friendly handshake agreements on the old dial-up telephones. And when the new person comes in, that's going to be very problematic, isn't it?
It is, and it has been already, you know, to a huge degree. And it's just that, you know, it just didn't used to work like that in Montana, but now it does, you know. And so I would encourage people that, you know, if they are doing something like that, you know, crossing somebody's property, would sure be nice to get that in writing, you know. As things are changing very quickly.
And I can relate. We've had a neighboring 200 irrigated acres sell a couple times in the last 10 years, probably three times, maybe even more. But since we're located near Red Lodge, there's, you know, it's highly desirable. There's going to be some turnover if people aren't committed for the long term. And our place obviously is, and one other neighbor is generational long term. And we've had this water usage unwritten, unrecorded agreement between the three ditch owners that, so our 120 inches, you know, we use minor inches in Montana and a lot of places in Montana. So we have 120, the neighbor has 200, the other neighbor has about 100. So one neighbor is fairly dominant, right? They have more. And that's the place that's turned over a couple times. And the way we irrigate up there is that you take the full ditch for 3 days, then you pass it, and they get the full ditch for 3 days. And it's not the legal way. I mean, you have a right to access your 200 inches anytime you want. And that is your 200 inches. But the way that those fields irrigate in that growing season, in the crop being used, grass, you want to flood it and the soils. There's a reason that you want to put all 600 inches down at once. And so that's always been the agreement between the unwritten, unrecorded agreement. And every time a new person buys that place next to us, we have to educate them. Hey, we understand that you have the right to access your 200 inches anytime you want. And we should get a box, and we should separate that. Here's the reason why we don't do that. And they have heartburn over it at first. Most newcomers don't like farmer agreements. They one thing, Ken, they might think that us good old boy neighbors are trying to screw them. We're trying to pull the wool over their eyes and pull one on them. They might think we're trying to screw them, but they soon do realize there's a reason, a method behind the madness, and it's mainly driven by the soil and the crop. But it just takes, you know, continuing communication.
Yeah. In a situation like that, a lot of times water's lost in conveyance too. So if you don't have the whole thing, you can get absolutely nothing done. And so, like you said, it's a compromise move, but it's hard to spring that on somebody that's not familiar with that system of neighboring, I guess.
Yeah. And another one is every time that changes hand, the last owner is behind on their ditch maintenance. And granted, someone just stepped in and they bought a $1.5 million place, and you tell them, oh, by the way, you owe $800 for his ditch maintenance. Oh, they get their panties in a bunch. They're just so upset about $800 on $1.5 million. I shouldn't have to pay that. That was his. It's like, well, we're never going to get it from him. If you want your water, it's $800.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. There's a lot in water conveyance. My uncle was a pro at making sure the water got to the point of attack. And so I learned a lot from my uncle as far as clean ditches and how to get the water from the pond or the stream bed to the field. It makes a huge difference.
Well, comment on that, because there's another cultural paradigm where you and I look at ranches and we see water for irrigation and livestock use. The new buyers in Mar County are saying, do I have enough water here? Is the point of diversion such that I can put up ponds, and I want to build ponds, and I want to change the channel, I want to change the point of diversion? And then going back to our little dispute on the East Bench near Red Lodge, I want my water all year long. And how do you feel about, I mean, I guess you and I we just have to accept it and say, hey, this is the world we live in, and you know, we got to make a living too. So if they want water for ponds, for amenity ponds, how have you been handling that?
Well, you know, we've been around, it's kind of amazing you brought that up, because we've been kind of suffering from pond overdose, but I do know that the DNRC is allowing now water for ponds, and they are recognizing that. So really there isn't a lot a guy can do with that. But I do know that in the future it's going to come up more and more often. And I'm close enough to the Bozeman area that I know it's just been a horror story over there.
The neighboring state of Bozeman.
Yeah, the neighboring state of Bozeman with ponds, because it seemed like everybody builds a pond, whether sometimes they were able to just, you know, dig in the ground, and you're kind of exposing the water, you know what I mean, the groundwater then, which I seemed like to me when you do that. But and those, a lot of those ponds, like toward Gateway, they're fed by irrigation ditches that leak. So they kind of dry up in the summer, or dry up in the wintertime, and then here they come in the summertime. And I know my brother and sister have a place over there, and one of their neighbors there decided to build their on a ditch that was conveying through him. They just built their pond right on his ditch. So the sad news is that there is no enforcement division of the DNRC. So then you have to fight that in court. So you may not have your, like in his case, he lost his water for the year because he had to fight that and to get that, you know, his ditch conveyed around the pond and onto his property. So it's a kind of continual nightmare that is in Montana. It's going to get a lot worse, actually, in the western part of Montana. And that's why, like with my business, I would hope to address that and tell people what they can do and what they can't do, you know. And I think that there's a lot of misinformation. It seemed like, I don't know, when they buy this piece, nobody's told them anything. Well, a lot of times they've came from area where they either know nothing about water or nothing about water rights. And so they just put in a pond, and then there's just great disappointment afterwards that they can't fill their pond, and they've spent a bunch of money for nothing. And that's one of the reasons I started my company, to try to help those people so they don't do that. You know,
a little bit of consulting goes a long way.
I think so.
Just a little bit of local knowledge and advice can keep you out of a attorney pickle. And then another thing, before it gets to the attorneys, why not practice mediation? Let's get another third party, independent, third objective opinion in here. And let's find a way to work this out without having to take it to the district court.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's just sad that, you know, like I say, the DNRC we've entered into several water right arrangements, but they don't have any teeth. I mean, they don't have an enforcement division. So you can come to the best damn agreement in the world, but you can't enforce it. So
we don't want them to have any teeth of enforcement.
I know.
I would rather they were castrated to the highest level.
Yeah, I understand totally. Yes. But I'm just saying, it's hard to manage. You know, you make an agreement, and yet there's nobody to oversee the agreement. So,
well, it starts with the water commissioner.
Yeah.
And, well, it starts with the private parties, property rights, agreement between parties, and then the commissioner can weigh in. And then if he can't figure out the resolution and educate both parties to why it is what it is and how it's going to be what it's going to be, then it should go to district court.
Right.
And yep. And you should have your local representatives, locally elected judge, weigh in on it.
Right.
And if it takes a locally assigned jury pool, they're going to find people like you who are of that local area to weigh in on this property rights, this landowner dispute. And the last thing we need is Montana becomes more absentee owned, more tourist occupied. You know, I would consider someone who's a 7-year hold visits for 4 weeks of the year at best. I mean, that's a form of tourism, right?
Absolutely.
You're not vested. You're not committed to the long term. But we want to keep that out of the water court and out of the state's hands, because the state, inevitably, they want control. They want your water rights. They want to tell you how it's going to happen.
It's been in the news the last several weeks. There have been a development on the east side of Cacapurian on Gulls, and they're stopping a development over there because of lack of water. And that's going to court, I think, fairly in the in the near future. And then can't think of the other one right off the tip of me that there's it's with Scudder's over there in groundwater. Yeah. So there's,
is that Bill Galt?
I think it's on Bill's place there.
So Bill Galt is one of the largest landowners in Montana, and him and my dad are taking up this issue. I don't know if you've heard that, but they are filing an amicus brief on behalf of Scudder's, which Scudder's is another family name, old Dutch potato farmers, huge landowners in the Gallatin Valley. And Bill Galt and my dad are taking the fight to the state. And that's probably why people can hear me come across as very pro local control.
Oh, yeah. Well, in all government, I mean, if it was all local control, we wouldn't have the mess we have right now in the country.
And,
so
yeah, and I'll just, any listeners who are with Montana DNRC, you're going to lose that one. Well, enough about my chatter. Tell me how this change has been. Has it been, I mean, it's been slow, right? It's been happening for 30 years.
Yeah.
Ted Turner, I think he bought his first Montana ranch in the late 80s. Which is when I was born. So I can say, like, you know, I don't know the era that you grew up in.
Yeah.
I've always been part of this absentee ownership, you could say.
Right. Exactly. I grew up when it was like when we bought that place in Plentywood, I keep telling everybody it's the greatest place in the world. It's like going back in Wilsall 30 years ago, because all the old farmers and ranchers are on the farms and ranch. And then in Wilsall, it's totally not the case anymore. It's very few of the family ranchers are left there, and you lose a lot of community. But I mean, it seems like those lifetime guys are so vested in the community that they are just, I mean, you can't even describe it. It's beyond reproach. You just can't do it. I mean, it's just like those Plentywood people, you know. If there's a funeral, they're all there. You know what I mean? It's like, and that's the way it used to be in Wilsall. And I'm not saying that it's not that way still in Wilsall, because people have really worked hard to keep it that way. But it's the people that have been around a while. I'm not saying some of the newer people haven't tried really hard, because they have. But I'm just saying it's a sense of community that you kind of lose through all this. You know, if I go to the bank bar after 10 o'clock, I won't know a soul in there. You know, it's crazy. You know, I used to know everybody in there in the bank bar after
or
10
White
o'clock.
Sulfur Springs on opening day of rifle season.
Yeah,
insane.
Exactly.
Insane.
Yeah. But it has really changed a lot. I mean, it started kind of when I was more in high school, and that's kind of when you'd see it in the 70s. And since then, it's kind of slowly, you know, as a ranch would go out, you know, it was just enough that was kind of out of egg range for trying to purchase it, you know. And I think the last big land deal we did was in the, we bought land all the way up to current, but the last huge deals we did were in the 70s and late 70s. And then the interest rates went to hell, and we got, We got, I think in 1971, we got 96 cents for the steer calves. And the next year, we got 27 cents for the steers, and we couldn't sell the heifers. So,
oh my goodness.
Oh man, that was, we went in, and then interest rates started up into the 20%. So we got welcome to the world of debt right in a hurry, you know?
Yeah. So I'm not the only one who has that story of buying high and selling low.
Yeah. It's been going on in the ag world forever. So yeah. And we keep doing it. We're consistent. We'll do it again tomorrow.
Yeah, that's right. But you weather the times and you weather the difficulties because your life depends on it. I mean, there is no outside income. There is no additional family wealth backing you, and you just got to cut costs and live thin like a coyote, a jackrabbit. And
yeah. And people, all of our suppliers all wonder why we're so tight with our money. Well, that's the only way we can cut costs.
Absolutely.
Is try to make the best deals, you know? So
yeah, I can recall my grandpa calling probably 5 or 6 different tire shops between Powell, Wyoming and Belgrade, Montana.
Oh, absolutely.
Looking to save $50 on a tractor tire.
Yeah, no, that's right. That's what we do. That's what we do, you know, and people think we're, like I said, thrifty, tight, whatever. But I mean, it's the only way you can save money. So
what's your business called?
It's Arthen Resources.
Arthen Resources.
Yeah.
And you were part of the Ringling Five.
Yeah, barely.
That sounds like organized crime syndication. Like,
yep, it pretty much was. Yeah. So, yeah.
That sounds like something that would be on a Netflix documentary.
Yeah, it should have been. Yeah, it was 40 some years of craziness. No, it was a wonderful deal.
What is the Ringling Five?
Well, I don't know. It started out, you know, for starters, it was my cousin Les, my brother Ron, and myself. So there's 3 Arthens in the group, and Larry Lovely, which I started Sunday school with when I was 5. And so people asked us, well, how long you guys been singing together? I said, well, golly, ever since I was in Sunday school when I was 5, you know, because that's all we did in Sunday school. We didn't have a lesson. We just sang. So it was a great, and
kind of like a homeschool band.
Yeah, pretty much. And so then we had a couple of tremendous music teachers, Mrs. Blinn in high school, and Mr. Arthen. He was an Absorkey Arthen.
Oh yeah.
And then we really didn't do anything with it. Larry Lovely always had a band, and then I don't know, we came home from college, we're all MSU Go Cats guys, and we came home from school, and I don't know, a honky-tonk piano player, we'd have some special events around, and she'd want us to write a song for that or sing a song. So we started singing some songs, and then we started writing some songs, and then that led to a whole lot of craziness, you know. So, I mean, thousands, well, I don't know how many, hundreds of thousands of miles, 2,000 shows.
Every mint bar and Stockman bar in Montana.
Pretty much.
There are many mints and Stockmans.
Yeah. If you sang in Garneal, Montana, or Ismay, you've sang about everywhere in Montana,
man,
and we did.
So tell me more about your services, which I assume does not include performing as the Ringling Five on the ranch.
Yeah, no, as far as my business services, we start out with range management. So we do a species identification, species analysis, and we do some range plots, GPS plots, and away from the waterways. People, you know, they always, you know, it's, you know, waterways or livestock developments for water, you know, they're gonna, you know, animals are lazy and they're always gonna pound that grass, and so you want to get your plots up away from that. So that's what we do, and then we actually clip and weigh those plots, and then we photograph them, and then you, we have a precip factor we add into that, and then you can actually measure the range and take pictures, and then it's for people that don't know and understand, and you know, you're not going to explain it much to, you know, an old time ranch guy, but for some of these newer people coming in, it gives them some actually proof that what we're looking at. And we do a species analysis of the wildlife, and they can, you know, you can, you know, I've seen them, a lot of food plots put in, and one of the newer landowners, the Shields, just put in several hundred acres and wanted to, you know, entice the elk in for hunting season, but the elk had it eaten up midsummer, so you know, there's a lot to be learned for that.
Maybe
you know?
Think about some warm season plants that last longer through the fall,
right? Or they'd actually would actually in that situation you'd have to fence them off, you know. So, and then we've done a ton of water development on our place, pipelines, spring development. I think I've developed at least 30 springs myself with a backhoe and one helper, and so we have had a ton of experience do that. And I was part of the Shields Watershed Group, and we've done some restoration work on the Shields and been able to see how that's worked out for people. And
generally, if it's good for the ruminant, it's good for the ungulate.
Yeah, that's right. That's
so
right.
So spring and pipeline and cross fencing and riparian habitat, you're going to do that. I mean, today's owner is going to do that for the wildlife, right? And for the amenity value, but it does improve the livestock operation, which then improves the soil, the grasses, the species, which then improves the wildlife.
Oh, tremendously. It's just, it can't be enough said. Like I was telling you earlier, you know, they have a tendency, the livestock and game will have a tendency to, you know, stay on the water when it gets hot in the summertime. And the more water developments, the more you can scatter the animals. And it's a win-win deal for everything and everybody, every species out there. So that's fantastic. So, yeah.
Yeah, that makes me also think about the new buyer set, which try not to have a value judgment upon. Everyone's free.
Right, exactly.
We are free. And exactly. To pursue our own dreams.
This is America.
Yeah, we get to pursue what we want. We have private property rights. And it's a beautiful thing to chase your dream. And a lot of these people are chasing their dreams. So I definitely don't want to come across like I'm shaming anyone, but they do lack insight into basic resource management. And in particular, I'm thinking about weeds.
Oh boy.
Weeds is a big one I come across when showing a place, and they're looking at the view. They're looking at the ponderosa pines. They're looking for elk. They're not looking down at the feet seeing, oh, this is knapweed or this is ventonata.
Or spurge.
Or leafy spurge. Yeah. And then in the event that I've been on showings where they, you know, call leafy spurge and spotted knapweed a pretty flower, right? Purple
exactly.
Pretty flower and or yellow pretty flower plants. And it's like, no, those are noxious weeds. And oh, okay. It's actually should be like, do you want to think of a plan how to control that, how to knock it out? Because that's kind of your obligation, you know, going back to community.
Right, exactly.
You take care of your side of the fence, make sure your side of the street is clean. Your neighbor's going to do the same.
Yeah, exactly.
Especially if you're committed for the long term, you're vested.
Yep. You can't say enough about that. I mean, as far as you can't be a pain in all your neighbor's rear end because, you know, you think it's a flower, not a weed, because it's, you know, it's going to not only take over the neighbor, but it might, you know, might take over the public ground next to the neighbor. So
government ground.
Yes.
I don't do, okay. we don't use the word public ground
okay.
on this podcast.
Okay.
The public does not have rights to shit on government. The government owns it. The public does not.
Yeah. They keep taking away, you know, what they say is, and then they'll say there's public access, but then they'll take it away in 5 years.
Well, if you think you own it, Mr. Public Landowners out there with your nifty little shirts and bumper stickers, just go set up a house and try, actually set up a tent and try to be there for 4 weeks, be left alone. And furthermore, you know, harbor something in that tent and see if the government needs a warrant to enter your tent on these quote unquote public lands. I digress, Ken. We're talking about your business.
So. No, totally. Yeah, no problem. No, it's very true. It's very true. So all the above. So
we were talking about responsible resource management. What goes into that?
Well, it's like you said, it's noxious weed control. It's It's water development, soil health. You hear a lot about rejuvenation and soil health, and you know, you can do a ton for that. One time I get so sick of when it rains 3 or 4 tenths or 5 tenths in our little valley, the rivers and the streams instantly turn brown. They instantly turn brown. So one day I said, my God, I'm so sick of this. And I thought, I got on my four-wheeler. I said, I'm just going to follow and see where this starts. And I started at my place, and I went up into the hills behind my house, and where it actually was coming from was an old growth fir on north slopes, because there's absolutely nothing growing under those old growth fir trees. It's absolutely totally bare ground. So it's old growth fir, and it rains just a doodle. If it runs at all, then it's going to run into those streams. So I don't know why in Montana we keep not looking at our greatest asset. It starts with the soil, and people do not understand that. And the Forest Service, I don't know, they haven't done anything about it. So they obviously don't don't seem to know anything about that. And I think that on government land, I think that they actually don't log the waterways. And I was thinking that would be the best thing to do, would be to log the waterways and have grass filter strips so it could stop some of that soil before it gets into the stream, rather than, you know, letting that old growth fir grow right into the waterway. So I don't know, I could be wrong on this deal. I'm not totally familiar with it. Maybe you know more, Coulter.
Timberland management? Us East Slopers do not do a lot of timberland management. when you're from an 11-inch precip zone, the trees are not of merchantable value.
Yeah, absolutely right. Yeah, for sure.
It generally comes down to encouraging a good root layer, right?
Right.
In the soil. And how do you do that? You use ruminants.
Right.
And the natural progression of timberland environments, which includes fire.
Right.
Includes thinning.
Right.
It includes rest rotations and changing season of use.
Right.
And yeah, I mean, you look at these ponderosa pine and Doug fir areas, and unfortunately cheatgrass is pretty prevalent, and cheatgrass is going to dry out earlier. So as you mentioned, 3/10 of an inch rainstorm, there's no grass there holding onto that soil, so it will sediment the waterways, unfortunately. And that's why the public doesn't own shit, because the public should be out there solving it. They should get out there and start rotating cows and sheep around a little better and spraying, but that's the government's responsibility. They own it, and their hands are always tied through administrations.
Yeah, absolutely. It is amazing that you can do more with grazing animals than you can do without them. And people don't, you know, I guess they're all into worrying about cow farts right now, but it's just amazing actually. And you talk about we had some land leased in the south of Livingston, higher mountain property, and the landowner was always worried about fire danger. And I'm going, my God, we had 400 cows up there. And I said, we got the best wildland fire preventers in the world right here. And just start around your house and kind of hit that a little harder and work yourself around. But it seemed like common sense knowledge. I know it's just amazing how we sometimes forget what cattle can actually do for a place, you know. Wildland fire prevention, all the way to just simply grass management and you know, reseeding the grass. And you know, our philosophy was always, you know, if unless it was a complete drought year, to, you know, take half, leave half. And that way you can kind of, it'll get you through the dry years, unless you get 3 or 4 stacked on each other. And on the wet years, you look like a king, you know, so you don't have to use the grass. So.
Well, given this is the Ranch Investor podcast, you're one of those families who took a beautiful mountain western Montana ranch and you expanded to eastern Montana. Tell me what went into that.
Well, it was a long process. It probably took 5 or 6 years, and we did a 1031, and
so you capitalized on those incredible land values in western Montana and grew your operation in the east, where dollar per acre, dollar per animal unit was more favorable.
Right, exactly. Yeah, and we sold it to my brother and cousin, so we were able to keep that in the family. And so we just look at it as growing the homestead. Now that's a weird way to look at it, but I think of it as that. And if I'd have sold to some outsider, I wouldn't have been able to sleep with myself, and I would have been talking out of both sides of my mouth on this podcast. But we didn't do that, and we're able to keep it in house, and very thankful for that. And they all speak to me at home still, so that's a great thing too.
You
so
can still go to the Mint and the Stockman,
right? And somebody will still buy me a drink, and so that's a good thing. Yeah, we had some friends up there, and my daughter actually married into the family kind of up in Plentywood too. And so we looked for a place for years and actually went door to door up there, to be honest with you, my son, and he had a good college friend, and that's kind of how that all started. And so we were patient, and finally we word of mouth heard about this place, the old Nash brothers place. There was actually an old New Holland dealership there in Redstone, Montana, and so they owned most of the town, and so we have most of the town.
Which Redstone was about three lots.
Yeah, three lots. Yeah. Yeah, and a bunch of broken down buildings, but we bought the farm with that. So, and it was a historic place too, and in fact, Mrs. Nash just died, and she was 90 some years old just a few weeks ago, and it was important to them that it sold to a family, you know what I mean? So my son's up there and took his three daughters and wife up there, and they're making plenty with home, you know, so.
Well, as we wrap this up, I want to hear a little more about your services and how people can get in touch with you. Where can they find you? How do they contact you?
Yeah, well, I just want to say I've dealt with a lot of family issues over the years too, and people. I was on the school board for 12 years and the farm credit board for 12 years. And so I have a lot of experience and with people. And in fact, I think the last school board election, I ran unopposed. And I think of the 246 votes, I got 220 some. And I thought, my God, if you can be on the school board for 12 years and only piss off 20 people, I thought I must have done a hell of a job. So I think that I can provide a lot of the services that I spoke about earlier. Plus, I have a lot of family experience and people experience. And I've always, you know, like you said, mediation would be way better than, you know, getting to the court system. I mean, the court system is there, I guess, if you, like you said, you know, if you have some water issues you have to address. But it sure is nice to settle things toe-to-toe sometimes. And that's sometimes, I think, what's most lost in this land's transferring into this the newer Montanans, you know. So I think I can provide that too. So if I have a website, it's arthunresources.com.
A-R-T-H-U-N.
Yeah, U-N. Yeah, resource.com. And I'll give my number too. It's 406-220-1556. So that's my phone number.
Well, I appreciate you coming on the podcast and giving your perspective. We certainly don't see the Wilkes brothers on school boards, do we?
Well, yeah, for sure we don't. And all that's part of Montana you probably won't see again. So,
No, this is in the rear view, and guys like you and I are trying to figure out how to add value looking through the windshield.
Absolutely, and thank you, Coulter, very much for having me on. It's been great chatting with you, and like you say, your name is so familiar too, and it's so cool to see that in Montana, just the coolest thing.
Well, Ken Arthun, arthunresources.com. Thanks for coming on the Ranch Investor Podcast. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much again, Coulter.
Click subscribe on your streaming platform so you know when the latest episode has dropped.